years ago, giving on typing. One point was commenting that he's a really knowledgeable geshe, a really good geshe. You take a single text and interpret it in 10 different ways. And each of them valid, each of them useful, relative to this person, that person, this context, that context. Quite an impression on me, because he was a very, very tight. His love of practice, but also just his love, he was like voracious, really. He's voracious, like if he would ever had any spare time, he would just be over the texts. Just learning more and more and more. He just never stopped being a student. Always more to learn, always more to learn. And yet, he wasn't just a scholar. Nobody can fake. Try it. Go ahead, try it. Sit for 3 hours, cross-legged, without moving, and not be screaming. So I'm not a good geshe, I'm not a bad geshe, I'm not a geshe at all. But in terms of this very sharp, simple approach that Benjana Moche takes for Vipassana, which I've not seen anywhere else. It may be everywhere else. I'm not very knowledgeable, but it really struck me in this one. You're familiar with it now, and I think you've all memorized it. And that is, you're probing into, attending to the phenomenon in question, whatever you're focusing on. You're looking at how does it appear, how does it exist, and how are you apprehending it. Just so I'd like for there to be great clarity on this point, right? So you know exactly what the words mean. Because if the conceptual understanding is fuzzy, it's going to be very difficult to have a very sharp practice if your conceptual understanding is fuzzy, vague. So I think we should never, disparage or underestimate the importance of having a very clear conceptual understanding. Sometimes they say, my understanding is only conceptual. That's a good start. That's where we need to start, right? Understanding from hearing and then reflection, and then you're ready. When you have that crystal clear, very sharp, tested, like a blade you put in the fire and tested. Okay, now I'm ready to meditate. And so, one term there that readily invites multiple interpretations is this ne luk, the way of being present, the way of abiding, the way of existence, nature of existence. And clearly, an undebatable point is that phenomena, such as David, for example, David exists, his way of existing conventionally, relatively, is as a human being and so forth, and as an ongoing stream of a sentient being who is caring about, suffering and so forth, so as described earlier. And that just doesn't go away. No matter what we do, no matter what deep insight we might have into emptiness, it never negates that. David never disappears, never negated, is untouched, untouched. And so when we had that conjunction, just by the sheer sequence of the retreat, where we were looking into Panchen Rinpoche's teachings on Vipassana, but in the morning we were practicing loving kindness, it didn't seem to me on that occasion the most optimal to go for the ultimate mode of existence. So Brendan, for example, Brendan's ultimate mode of existence, that's easy, empty of inherent nature, has just purely nominal existence, nothing more than merely a conceptual designation. But if I'm leading you into a practice of the cultivation of loving kindness, and now I say, now here it is, focus on all sentient beings as conceptual designations and wish them well. It might be a bit of a stretch, right? So better to focus on, how is Brendan? How is David? How are they present? And yes, we can say from this ultimate perspective, as a mere name, a mere label, a mere conceptual limitation, but it's also true. Is there an ongoing, let's just come back, is there an ongoing person throughout the course of the life, from lifetime to lifetime? And the answer is yes. Yeah. So, but now we're going deep into Vipassana territory. So last time, that is when I first introduced this triad from Benjana Moche, then I highlighted this nature of existence, the way of being present, emphasized the relative nature of it, that although we appear in various ways, something angry, compassionate, generous, and stingy, myriad appearances, agreeable and disagreeable, underlying that. So I'm repeating myself a little bit. But I don't take any of that back. I think it's all true. But now we're going for the gold. It's Vipassana time. It's time to really try to penetrate into, by way of ontological probe, ontological analysis. What is the way the person, the individual, the entity, how does it actually exist? Right? And in this regard, I'd like to set up the next meditation briefly, kind of front load it a bit. But I'm going to interpret it differently. So I can't do it in 10 different ways, but 2 different ways I think I can handle that. And that is when you see these two terms paired, Niluk or Netsul and Nangsul, Nangluk, the way of appearing and the way of existing. When you see that normally in Madhyamaka literature, it's very clear what it means. How it appears, that's conventional, relative, right? How it exists, well, this is where the whole issue of the contrariness, the incompatibility, how appearances mislead, right? Because as I gaze over at Wendy, Wendy appears to be from her own side. She appears to be over there. Big lie, right? As His Holiness says, very poignantly, when I saw him do this, it really left a big impression. He said, when you, especially you jab your finger, like that, especially if there's some attachment or anger, some mental affliction operative, and we start poking our fingers at people. Like, Wendy, didn't I tell you to clean up a floor yesterday? What's wrong with you? Like that, something like that. When the, it's kind of, you know, there's some energy behind that, right? That which you're pointing your finger at, that's what doesn't exist. Right there. He said, zuguzuksa, what you're pointing your finger at, that's what doesn't exist. It's not that Wendy doesn't exist, but Wendy, there from her own side, self-supportive, autonomous, really over there, really objectively, that's exactly what doesn't exist. But she certainly seems to. So when speaking of Niluk, it's that sheer absence of existing from her own side. That's the Niluk. That's the ultimate mode of existence. That's what this meditation is all about, to realize the emptiness of all phenomena. So now we go to the meditation. I'd like to just put a little bit of different twist on it. I suspect it's probably what Benjana Mucha had in mind when he paired these two, way of appearing, way of existence, and again, it's almost always highlighted, look, they're different, they're really, really different. And then how do we recognize the difference? Not simply believe it, not just simply get the right answers at the end of the book, you know the right Madhyamaka answers. How can we, and without getting caught up in a lot of philosophizing, cogitating, reasoning, logical arguments, and so forth, all of which has a place. I'm not disparaging that at all. But he is giving us a more slender route here. Really slender, as in just like an arrow hitting a target. You know, boom, just like that. Very Mahamudra, very Dzogchen. And so here's a method. I think it's what he had in mind. First of all, attend to how phenomena appear. In the scene, let it be just the scene. So just try to get good signal-to-noise ratio. That is, when you're attending to appearances of the world around you, by way of the 5 sense, physical sense doors, appearances arising in the mind, just try to get a, and this is where your shamatha is going to be enormously helpful. The more you have, the better it will be. Try to get a good, you know, clear signal, really low noise. Just see what's appearing. See the appearances as appearances with as much freedom from additives as possible. Any type of additives at all, just naked, right? So try to get a good take on that, like gacha. The Tibetan word is nyepa, ascertain that, right? But now in the practice we're about to do, we're not going to suppress or, how do you say, marginalize or peripheralize the conceptual apparatus by which we're making sense of the world. So it's more in the mode of settling the mind in its natural state. Open the Pandora's box. If the mind want to talk, let the mind talk. If it want to go blah, 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 can let it go blah, blah, blah. Let it come out with a lot of nouns. It's going to do it anyway, but don't make it shut up. A lot of nouns. Nouns refer to objects, right? Objects have qualities. They're out there, they're in here. It's people, it's trees, it's plants, it's thoughts, it's emotions, it's me, it's mind. Those are all nouns, which means they have attributes. And so when we allow the conceptual mind off the leash and let it designate away, you know, as he keeps on saying, but he must really mean it, Benjana Mucha, from the state of equipoise, remember, from the state of ease, always saying, you did get the shamatha, right? You did get it, because you need that now. From that, you didn't skip it, did you? You know. So from that, our best approximation, what can we do? We're here for 8 weeks and not for 8 years. From that, observe your objectifying phenomena. Not just seeing appearances, but seeing Wendy, seeing Daniel, seeing Brendan. They're not just appearances. They're people. Very importantly, they look back. Appearances don't look back. And so as you designate, then this is where the really intelligent introspection comes in. This is where we're definitely into Vipassana territory. We're not just trying to stabilize the mind here. And that is, as you designate this or that, anything that comes up, and you can do it deliberately. You don't just have to wait for it to happen spontaneously. You can, from that state of equipoise, deliberately bring someone, something, some place, some object or some subject to mind, a noun, bring it to mind, designate it, and then watch very carefully. If, first of all, almost like holding and working memory, you've got a clear sense of the way appearances are arising. They're just empty appearances, right? It's kind of easy to see that. They're just appearances. The color, the smells, the sounds, the tastes, the thoughts, the images. It's kind of like, yeah, they're just images arising in the space of awareness. They're just empty appearances. That's not too hard. It's when we start objectifying things, that's when the reification comes in. So when you do, when the conceptual mind does designate, here it is. You ready? Because this is the part to remember. When you see that your mind, your conceptual mind is objectifying something, identify what's the basis of designation of the designation. Okay? So I said before, you remember, in settling the mind in its natural state, I said, it's enough if I gaze over at Maria's face, just as an analogy, I gaze over at Maria's face, and somebody asks me, do you know where Maria is? Yeah, she's right over there. And that's perfectly fine. So that's enough. To see Maria, I don't really need to see anything more. I don't need to see her back or her right shoulder and so forth. Face is enough. It's a perfectly good basis of designation for saying Maria's right there, right? Right? That's fine when you're settling the mind in its natural state. You're observing the mind by way of whatever comes up. Thoughts, mental images, desires, emotions, space of the mind. They're all suitable bases of designation for the mind. But now we're not just satisfied with that. When an object comes to mind and you designate, then ask, see what is the basis of designation. For right now, when I look over Maria, I mean, I just naturally look at the face and then I naturally say, oh, there's Maria, right? But then when you're doing this in meditation, then note, here comes a really important point. Note, her face was my basis of designation for designating her, by which I identified her. She's there. And her face is completely empty of Maria. I mean, you could take every atom of the face, collectively, individually, the shape, the colors, and so forth. You could do a full-scale, total, complete analysis of her face. And nowhere in any aspect of the face, individually or collectively, will you find even the tiniest trace of a person. The face is empty of Maria. The basis of designation, this is the crucial point. The basis of designation is totally empty of the designated object. As a cairn, a pile of stones, is totally empty of a person. Right? He said that, right? As a striped rope is totally empty of a snake. The appearance is empty of anything you impute upon it. That doesn't mean, though, that Maria doesn't exist. But right now, we're distinguishing that there's a mode of appearance. It's an appearance of a face. I've just designated, oh, there's Maria over there. I know. Apprehend means, how do you identify? How do you know? What's your way of identifying the mode of apprehension? So it can be perceptual, but it also can be conceptual. Where is she? Oh, she's right over there. I remember Maria. That's conceptual. Embedded in a conceptual framework, right? And so, note again, you're in the scene, just the scene, the mode of appearances. Then note how you identify whatever comes to mind, any noun, could be a verb for that matter. And then note the basis of designation. And holding in mind that yes, I am apprehending Maria. I'm not delusional here. I am apprehending someone who does exist. So that's not delusional. But now, how does Maria exist? Well, she's not there objectively. She's not there from her own side. And the basis upon which I designated her, identified her, imputed her, named her, is completely empty of Maria. Just as when you gaze at your reflection in a mirror, and the mirror is 2 meters in front of you, and you see the reflection 2 meters behind the surface of the mirror, there's absolutely nothing there, 2 meters behind the mirror, that in any way corresponds. I mean, there's just nothing there at all. It could be granite. It could be anything, but what it is totally empty of that reflection. There's no reflection there. And yet you can photograph it. And the camera lens will tell you, that's where it is. That's the remarkable part. I discovered that one. You know, millions of people know this, but I discovered it when I was 20. Photographing. I was in Germany. I was photographing very close to the surface of a little pool outside of Göttingen. And I was focusing in with my lens 6 inches away from the surface of the water. And I was focusing in on the reflections of the trees on the far bank. And I wanted to get the trees in focus. And lo and behold, I was starting at like, okay, 2 feet or 6 inches. And then, oh. I'm looking right down there and the image is 40 feet away. Quite a surprise. And that's where the trees come in focus when you snap the shutter. That's where they're focused. They appear there. In a manner of speaking, they are there. You can photograph it. And of course there's no image down there. In the mud, 30 feet below the surface of the water, there's an image? I don't think so. And yet that's where it is. And it's not anywhere else. So there's the point. Is it clear? How things appear, that's straightforward. But you do need to get a clear signal. Because if we don't, and this is where bare attention comes in. This is where the Vipassana movement is so popular, for good reason. Just bare attention. Just be aware of whatever's coming up, here and now, non-judgmental. They're trying to get a good signal. You know, that's valuable. It's not yet Vipassana, and it's not Shamatha. But boy, it's laying the good groundwork. If people would actually move from there, they would really head out on a path. If they stay there, there won't be any path at all, generally speaking. Unless you're Bahia, then you'll be something special. And so, motive appearances, got that. And then observing the basis of designation, whenever you identify anything, including your mind. Now we're not going to be satisfied. Oh, I saw a thought, that's good enough, I saw my mind. No, your thought is not your mind. A thought's a thought. A thought isn't a mind. An emotion isn't a mind. The space of the mind is the space of the mind. It's not the mind. Otherwise it wouldn't be a quality of the mind, and it's called the space of the mind. Therefore it's not the same. It's not the mind of the mind, it's the space of the mind. And you can continue going there. And every single time there's going to be a difference between the basis of designation and what you designate upon it. And the basis of designation is always empty of that which you designate upon it. And therefore, this immediately follows. Therefore, the designated object does not exist from its own side. If it is, you'd find it. If it is, you'd find a basis of designation which actually is identical to the designated object. Never the case. At least that's the hypothesis. So, I will guide this meditation. But now it's a very different take, right? And we're not going to be worrying right now, but I don't want to dismiss all sentient beings. Don't worry, we'll get back to them tomorrow morning. They'll be there, you know? And we have to be bold. When we're looking for the middle way, don't be afraid to bounce off of extremes. A number of you, when you met with me one-on-one, you said, oh, in your last meditation, it was like you were banging me against the wall, this way and this way, just beating you up, bang, bang, against this wall and that wall. Yeah, I'm good at that. I do my best. And why? Because you find the middle way only by banging off the extremes. I don't know anybody. They say, oh, middle way, I'll just go there. And you just see those two extremes stream right by you. Oh, thank goodness I'm not there. Again, they're always exceptional people. But the rest of us, we find the middle way by saying, that was substantialism. I won't call it eternalism. But when we're really feeling the heart open and the moisture of loving kindness, of affection really is flowing, will there be a bit of reification of the people we're attending to? Probably so, yeah. Don't worry too much. That's a time if you slip over into a bit of substantialism. Okay. Cost-benefit analysis. It's okay. On the other hand, when you're really going for Vipassana, and you're saying, yeah, there's Lim, but she's not there. She's not really there from her own side at all. She's empty appearances, the matrix of empty appearances. then limb starts to slip away a little bit. Or maybe I start slipping away and getting a bit afraid, like if he doesn't exist, probably I don't exist either, and then grab my collar or something. If you get a little bit afraid when you're doing this practice, good. Some of you told me, I got a little bit afraid. I smile. Good. If you're not at all afraid, you're either doing really, really well, or you're not. Get a little bit afraid. Okay. All clear. Tutto, how do you say? Tutto chiaro? Tutto chiaro. Ah, molto bene. Good. Find a comfortable position. I'll beat up your mind, but at least your body should be comfortable. As if you're a pilot getting into a cockpit and checking the whole control panel. See that everything is in working order, everything's smooth. Then you take off. Similarly, before you launch into the wilderness of Vipassana, see that your body, speech, and mind are settled in a state of dynamic equipoise, settled in their natural state. From that still point of awareness simply resting, but with no vector, no directionality, from that stillness, that sense of ease, freedom from grasping, clear signal, no noise, let your eyes be open. And let's briefly follow the scenic route that the Buddha led Bahia on. Direct the full force of your mental awareness to the visual field. And in visual appearances, let there be just visual appearances. See how they appear. and turn your attention to the auditory field. In the heard, let be just the heard. Like we're running multiple cinemas simultaneously now. The eyes still open, the visual show still presenting itself from moment to moment. Now the auditory show chimes in. We now have a duet. Non-overlapping shows. You don't hear any colors or shapes. You don't see any sounds. Turn your attention to the tactile field. You don't hear any tactile sensations or see them, but observe in the felt, let it be just the felt, tactile sensations arising in the space of the body. As ownerless as our colors and shapes and sounds, mere appearances having no owner. We'll overlook smells and tastes, probably not much signal there. Direct the attention now to the space of the mind. Whenever appearances arise within this domain, we now have a quartet, visual, auditory, tactile, and mental. You recall when we first entered into the practice of settling the mind in its natural state. I said an entry into the practice was to deliberately generate a discursive thought, a mental image, or possibly a desire or an emotion. Doing it very deliberately, and then once it's been generated, observe it closely until it fades away. Now we move into Vipassana territory. So to start this, do something very easy. Deliberately think of anything you like. Bring someone or something to mind from the surrounding environment. Identify it. Now with precision, identify the basis upon which you've imputed this person or thing. Distinguish between the designated object and the basis of designation. See for yourself, was the designated object already there? Did you simply give a label to what was already there objectively? Was it there in the basis of designation? was it identical to the basis of designation? You must examine for yourself and come to certainty. And if that basis of designation is completely empty of the object you've designated upon that basis, does it not follow then that the designated object doesn't exist there? It's empty of such objective inherent existence. It's purely a designation, having only a nominal status. And that's how it really exists. Is it true or false? You must examine for yourself until the clarity, certainty comes to mind. You can continue in the practice now, not only in this domain of the mind, but with your eyes still wide open, your ears open, tactile sensations clearly appearing. See how the mind identifies objects in the visual field, the auditory, the tactile. Note how you apprehend, how you identify, how you know these objects that come to mind. And what this means is identify the basis of designation, identify the designated object, see whether they are the same or different, and if they are different, see whether there's a designated object is already there in the basis of designation, or whether that basis is utterly empty of the designated object. Let your mind roam freely now. Mind is very liberal, very generous in its designations. It designates objects in the visual field, the auditory, the tactile, and the mental. Within the mental, it may designate objects from the past. You may remember events or people, places, things from the past. Examine the basis of designation and so on. You may imagine events, people, situations in the future. Designation has occurred. Examine in the same way, each time. Distinguish between the mode of appearance and the mode of existence, and the role of designation. we quite rightly say that we're engaging in this meditation with our minds. We're putting our mind to this, our mind to that. So now we turn the same ontological probe in upon the mind that is aware. You must have some sense, my mind, or the mind, when this noun comes to mind. And it does many times. What's the basis of designation of mind? The designated object, of course, is mind. What's the basis of designation? And is it identical to mind as you understand the term? Examine closely. Then we have this term we're all familiar with. It's meaningful, it makes sense to all of us here, all of us living, listening by podcast. The flow of awareness, the stream of consciousness. We've been resting in it, observing it. So there's a noun. Consciousness. Spread out over time, the stream of consciousness. A noun. What's the basis of designation? You know what the right answer should be. The basis of a designation should not be identical to the object designated upon it. But is that the case? Have you now finally found something that is inherently real, truly existent? Consciousness existing by its own inherent nature. independently of any conceptual designation. Is it so or is it not? Examine the basis of designation upon which you impute consciousness or stream of consciousness, and examine closely. Are they the same or different? You are the meditator, are you not? You're the one doing this practice. You're the one resting to your best ability in meditative equipoise. When you identify yourself as such, what's the basis of designation? When some insight arises into the emptiness of inherent nature of the designated objects, rest, sustain that flow of awareness, that cognizance, that realization. Dwell in it, let it seep in. But it occurred to me that something obvious, and that is that there are different ways of viewing other sentient beings. But here more specifically, while identifying oneself as male, female, Brazilian, German, what have you, identifying that, and probably reifying, because that's what we do. You know? I'm over here. So in this case, American male, California. Stanford PhD. Viewing that, and of course that's true as far as it goes, but then reifying it. Because that's what we do. I'm over here. You don't have a Stanford PhD. I do. Right. Reifying. And joking aside, but just basically reifying oneself as a human being over here. Then it's very easy. It happens, especially when we're in the thralls of attachment or anger, mental afflictions, to simply objectify other human beings, and let alone other sentient beings, animals and so forth. Objectify them, what has been called the I-it relationship, right? The I-it relationship. Very, very cruel, right? To view another sentient being, human being or otherwise, as an it, as having no more sentience than an eyeglass carrier. That's very cruel, right? Because it's denying the very existence, the integrity, the not only the humanity, the sentient beingness of others. That's why, you know, so much passion. Sometimes it's ridiculous, I think. I look like a character, like a cartoon, when I keep on so vehemently critiquing scientific materialism. Because they're doing that all the time. You are a brain. You are a brain. You are a body. Your body. But a brain isn't a sentient being. And a body isn't a sentient being. And your mind is just an emergent property of matter. That's not a sentient being. So to my mind, it's worse than racism. Racism tends to target a group, skin color, ethnic background, religion, or what have you, and cordon those people off. You are merely animals. You are not really human. You're subhuman. And then any kind of brutality is okay, right? In the slave trade, it was just unimaginable what these good Christians would do. It defies the imagination. Like, how could they? Well, it was very easy. There's an answer to that question. They dehumanized them. They don't have feelings like us. So it looks cruel, but don't be upset. They look like they have feelings and emotions like us, but it's not true. They're really just animals. And this is right in the current where Descartes was still very powerful. Animals don't have feelings. Animals don't even have consciousness. And that's 400 years ago. But when we look at the savagery throughout human history, when any group does that towards another, I may as well start at home. The European Americans, how we treated the Native Americans. Unbelievable. Well, that's because they're savages, right? They're savages. They're not like us. They're animals. They're just really animals. That's what philosophers of mind are telling us all the time nowadays. You're just an animal. You're just a product of evolution. They are saying to all of humanity what the racists said of the Native Americans, to the blacks, to the Chinese, to any other minority group that they kind of felt, you know, negative against. Irish, Scottish, Italians, and so on. And as soon as you've done that, it's no holds barred. You can do anything. That's why such passion arises in me, because this is so incredibly dangerous to view all human beings, and of course all other sentient beings, as mere appearances, I-it relationship, making that a profession and suggesting there's scientific credibility behind that. Oh, that gets me excited. That gets me going, because I adore science. I hope that's obvious by now. I'm about to quote some science pretty soon. Paul, with such respect. So that's really savage. That's so dehumanizing. But it's beyond dehumanizing. It's de-sentient beingizing, you know. It's really treating sentient beings, ants, rodents, birds, reptiles, and so forth, as having nothing more than, I feel no qualms at all about slapping, I can spit on it, I can stamp it under my heel. An eyeglass carrier, I have no qualms at all. No problem. I'm not hurting anybody. It doesn't matter. My head hurts a little bit. It doesn't hurt at all. You know, no problem. So that's really awful. It's really grotesque. I mean, I would just try to find stronger and stronger adjectives for this, because it allows any type of savagery. It allows everything. Just as I would have no qualms about ripping this to shreds, cutting it into pieces, burning it, torching it. No qualms. No problem. Why should anybody care? Now imagine that's a sentient being. And we've been doing it a lot, you know? So moving beyond that type of catastrophic, malevolent dementia, operating out of simple okay, let alone the joking business about Stanford and all of that. Just, I'm a human being, I'm American, I'm a man. Okay, that's safe, that's okay. But then you're not. You're not American, you're not a man. And so, but I'm attending to, as I look over at Wendy, I'm attending to Wendy. And I'm attending to someone, and I can see it's very, very strong, very clear. Somebody's looking back. She's not a brain, she's not just a body, she's a human being, I'm a human being. She's not me, because I'm very different, but enough, but I recognize something coming back. So now I have to take that seriously. Right? Martin Buber called the first one I-it relationship. That is just like so toxic, you can't even find a word big enough. You know. But now it's an I-you relationship. But it's polarized. But at least, for heaven's sakes, I'm acknowledging you're there. And somebody's looking back. Right? I'm reifying myself. I'm reifying Wendy. But if she looks like she's in pain, any normal person would come back, oh, Wendy, what's wrong? Are you in pain? It looks like you're really having trouble there. Can I help? You know, that's just normal. That's where I have no reason to block. You know, she's yet subhuman or can't stand those Brits, you know. No problem, no barrier coming up. So if I see her apparently in pain, just do the natural thing. You don't have to cultivate it. Just do the natural thing. Are you okay? Do you need help? It's totally natural, right? Spontaneous. Because there's no barrier there. It's an I-you relationship. Reified myself, reified you. I'm aware that I'm acting courteously, you know, kindly, empathetically. That's good. That's a step in the right direction, right? But this point here that I'm really emphasizing, attending to someone and having the sense they're looking back. They're at the center of their mandala. The center of their mandala is over yonder. And the center of my mandala is over hither. Yeah. So, in other words, saturated by dualistic grasping, right? But nevertheless, boy, is that better than an I-it relationship. Just inconceivably better. Still delusional. But, boy, is it not like that, right? Going deeper and viewing from subtle mind. So that was coarse mind, right? Male, American, all the additives you want to add. Go deeper down to subtle mind. Imagine you viewing sentient beings from the continuum of subtle mind. Now the commonality is much, much deeper. Because Wendy's subtle mind is very similar to mine, much more than her body being similar to my body. Some very obvious differences. But you go to subtle mind, all the differences are not so evident at all. And moreover, my body doesn't look much like a lizard or a fly or a hummingbird. But then the subtle continuum of consciousness of a fly, you know, a hummingbird and so forth, oh, very similar, very similar. So, but still over there, right, still over there. But now that common ground, that sense of empathy, St. Francis having that such an open heart for animals, you know, so famous for that. Shantideva the same. Shantideva, you probably know the story, when he was meditating in his cave. This was after he left Nalanda, you know, flew away, levitated away. And then he appeared someplace. He appeared living living anonymously as a yogi out in a cave. And the villagers, they didn't know who he was, an anonymous guy, you know, some shramana, whatever, one of those guys. But animals kept on coming into his cave. Remember the story? And the villagers started getting really suspicious. Oh, that yogi, Sutta yogi, animals are coming, he's luring them in, he's eating them. They thought he was butchering all the animals that came into his cave. So they went to, you know, because shramanas shouldn't do that. You know, they shouldn't be carnivores, killing animals that come in. So they went in to kind of accost this yogi that was devouring all the, expecting animal bones all over the place. And the animals were there with him. They just gathered around, like coming to a warm fire on a cold evening. You know. So for those really with great depth, like a St. Francis, like a Shantideva, the animals get it. The animals get it, you know. You know, here's no danger. All those other human beings, they're going to be dangerous. This one is okay, you know? So that's deeper. But still, that very important point, there's someone looking back. I hurt, that person hurts. If I speak harshly, that person will hurt. Hurt just like I hurt, you know? Very dualistic. But why, what a breath of fresh air. As opposed to let alone being in a materialist, just being aloof, indifferent, and egocentric. And really not being concerned for the well-being of others, just kind of bullying one's way through, regardless of worldview. You may call yourself a Christian or a Buddhist in a way, who cares, because you're just treating other people like its. And that happens when the mind is dominated by craving, self-centered attachment, and so forth. But now, let's go deeper. We can only do this in imagination unless you're very real. But imagine you cut through. You see the emptiness of inherent nature, of your own subtle continuum of consciousness. See, that too is empty. That too is not really over here. And you see that, you cut through that, which means, of course, that the subtle continuum of consciousness of Wendy or of Maria and so forth is not really over there. And you cut through that. You cut through that to pristine awareness, to Rigpa. And you're dwelling in Rigpa. And you don't have to close your eyes. You know, you can't open your eyes when you're dwelling in Rigpa. That's the idea. Eyes closed, eyes open. On the cushion, off the cushion. Your practice is simply very simple. Don't do anything and continue to maintain that view, resting in Rigpa at all times. Your practice now is extremely simple. It doesn't need to be complemented, balanced with anything else. Because you're resting in ultimate bodhicitta. Relative bodhicitta will come out, no worries. You know, it's come out for free. This is a perspective that is now completely transcending all dualistic grasping. So there is now no notion. I'm viewing from over here, and you're over there. If Martin Buber knew Dzogchen, then he would call this the I-thou relationship, where the sense of intimacy, the sense of affinity, the sense of non-duality is there, that there's simply a field awareness that is not polarized into you and me, subject and object, and so forth. It's a non-local awareness, because Rigpa isn't located inside my head or where I am over here. Therefore, if I attend to you, if I look over to Gatche, I'm not attending to her Rigpa over there, because her Rigpa has no center. My Rigpa has no center. They're non-dual. So this one's unimaginable. But then you transcend the very notion that person is looking at me from over there, because there's no over here. If there's no left, there's no right. If there's no up, there's no down. And if there's no over here, there's no over there either. That'd be good. Okay. I thought that might be useful. It came up. What can I say? It came up. So, I want to go back very briefly to something he alluded to very briefly in the text. Back to the text. Where he said something very briefly and then moved right on. And that is to say, the individual elements are not real because they are composites. He's talking about everything from elementary particles right up to the universe, galaxies, galactic clusters, and so forth. Everything from the most minute to the largest. Because that those individual elements, those six elements, that was to be intended to be all-inclusive. The galaxies are composed of the four elements within space. We're aware of them with consciousness. Elementary particles consist of, to varying degrees, four elements. Some of them may be kind of like extremely minute, like I don't know how much moisture there is in an electron. But in any case, they have material attributes. And so when he says they're not real, they're composites. And we looked at that briefly, but I wanted to return briefly. And that is, a cell phone is clear, obviously a composite. So obviously. Got earth element, water. There's not much water right now. Could. But as some fire element, otherwise it would be absolute zero Kelvin. And it has, I mean, it's on, it's turned on, so there's had to be some activity in there. That would be air element. So, but it's, most importantly, it's a composite. It's got a face, it's got inside, and so forth and so on. So it has a basis of designation. You can find it yourself. Am I holding a cell phone in my hand? Yes or no? Look at the basis of designation. When you identify correctly, you apprehend that I am holding a cell phone in my hand. And then you can examine the basis of designation. Is that a cell phone? And I'll be very certain that it's not, but you can decide that for yourself. Right? But here, if we were reading this from the 19th century, one might very well, very reasonably, very intelligently say, I get your point, but your point is trivial. And that is, okay, The cell phone, definitely. The cell phone as a cell phone. This is clearly a label, and it's imputed upon an aggregation of particles, of molecules, elementary particles, and so forth. There's energy in there as well. It's turned on, energy in there as well. And so, yes, the notion cell phone, smartphone, iPhone, these are just names. They're just conceptual constructs. And they are being imputed upon what's really in my hand. And what's really in my hand is not by its own intrinsic nature, a cell phone, etc., etc. But from 19th century, like 1870, for example, right when psychology began, they can say, well, that's all true, but you're missing the point. And that is, there is something that's really here, in my hand, really here, regardless of what you think, regardless of what you call, all this fancy business of conceptual designated objects and basis of designation. There's something that just kind of like superficializes everything you're saying here. And that is what's really in my hand, objectively, inherently, absolutely real, is there are material particles. And you can call them anything you like, but there are material particles. There are atoms here. And there's energy in there. So there are fields generated, electromagnetic fields. Let's say it's post James Clerk Maxwell. So what, 1879 or so. So okay, we got a notion of fields. And that electromagnetic fields, they demonstrate wave properties, very well known by 1880, 1890. And that's what's really here. Now you can call it anything you like. I don't care what you call it. But there are molecules here, there are atoms here. And before long, by the turn of the century or so, they started to identify electrons. I think that was 1910 or so. J.J. Thompson, I believe it was. So elementary particles are cropping up during the first decade, two decades of the century, 20th century. And that's what's really here. And they're inherently existent. So all these larger configurations of trees, how is a tree different from a bush? When does a tree become a tree? When does a seed germinate into a sprout? They say, I'm sorry, but you people have just gotten caught up in your head so much. You've lost touch with reality. Because what's really there, from the seed germinating to the sprout and so forth, I don't care whether you call it a seed or a sprout. That's just a manner of speaking. What's really there is molecules, atoms. And if I throw a seed at you, it's going to hit your forehead. And you can call it what you like. But I just threw an inherently existent seed at your forehead and it bounced off your inherently existent head. And that's because there's a certain density of the molecules in your head and a density of the kernel of the corn. And bing! And so that's how I disprove Madhyamaka, by throwing a kernel of corn against your head and watch it bounce off. Are we finished? So frankly, I'd say it would be very difficult to introduce Madhyamaka into the 19th century. Because they'd say, this is just, you're doing what philosophers do. You get caught up in your heads with all this fancy jargon and so forth. But we physicists are dealing with stuff that's real. Particles and fields. And you can call them anything you like, but they were there already and we discovered them. Right? Then lo and behold, you come back to Buddhist philosophy and you say, wait a minute, I'm sure I've heard this before. Have you ever heard this before? That the configurations are merely conventional, they're relative. And some people may call this a doorstop, and some people may call it a paperweight, and some people may call it a telephone, and other people call it a camera, and other people call it, you know, whatever. It's called Vaibhashika. It's considered the most, frankly, the most primitive, the most fundamental, most simple, coarse, not refined, of all the philosophical schools in Buddhism. And what Vaibhashika says, and this is the Abhidhamma, this is Vasubandhu, and so forth, is that what's ultimately real here in my hand are the atoms that make up the entity. They're really real, absolutely real. And the configurations, well, what configuration? When does a cell phone break? How much has to be there for it to be a cell phone? That's nominal. Is a broken cell phone still a cell phone? If I take off the face, is it still a cell phone? That's nominal. It's just words. But what's really absolutely ultimately there are the molecules. And it doesn't matter what you call them, how you designate them. That's all just airy-fairy philosophical shenanigans. What's really there are the particles. And then you say, well, what about the mind? What about the mind? I have moods, I have thoughts, emotions, and so forth. And when I look at Vesa's designation, it's never the same. You say, yep, you're right. Yep, moods, thoughts, perceptions, image and so forth, yep, they're conventional too. But there's something that's ultimately real mentally, and those are the individual moments of consciousness, those pulses of consciousness, primitive, raw, inherently existent, pulse, 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 pulse. Before they get into configurations, I'm feeling drowsy, I'm feeling upset, I'm feeling ambivalent. Those are configurations. Call them whatever you like. Those are configurations. They're not ultimately real. They're configurations, but we're being an ontological reductionist here as a vibhashika, which has always been looking, Buddhism always looking equally at, you know, acknowledging there's material phenomena and mental phenomena, and there are things that are neither mental nor familiar, nor neither mental nor physical. This has been old hat. So we have to get out of the rut in modern neuroscience and philosophy of mind of thinking you're either a monist, everything boils down to matter, or you're a dualist, as if those are the only two options. Like, get an imagination. That's a severe symptom of imagination deficit disorder, which Buddhism has never suffered from at all. They've always been multiplicative, always pluralistic, and it's open-ended. So we don't have to be Cartesian, and we don't have to be, you know, devotees of Thomas Huxley either, as a materialistic monist. So there it is. So Vaibhashika, chew on that one. That what's ultimately real are individual moments of consciousness, and individual atoms, and all the configurations of them, moods, perceptions, emotions, blah, 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 and tables and chairs and galaxies and so forth, they're conventional, but the raw nitty-gritty, the ball bearings of the mind are the individual kshana, the individual moments, pulses of cognizance, of awareness. And what out there physically, individual atoms. It's Democritus all over again, except for Democritus was a materialist. And Buddhism never fell into that trap. So what do we do about that? That's why I'm so glad not to be teaching this in the 19th century. Because it would be all of science against us, and it looks like we're just, you know, doing weird stuff with our minds. So let's not read this from the 19th century, because that physics is completely discredited. Completely discredited. Nobody who knows quantum mechanics or relativity can with a straight face say, yo-yo. Space, time, matter, energy, absolutely real, existing by their own characteristics, independently of context, like relative inertial frame of reference. Nobody can say that, not if you're all informed. And if you study quantum mechanics, you're going to have a real hard time basically refuted. It's gone. So let alone 20th century, let's go to the 21st century. And I'm now, when I cite quantum cosmology, and citing Stephen Hawking, Andre Lind, and so forth, John Wheeler, I want to very freely acknowledge, number one, there's just no question, these are absolutely world-class physicists, top drawer. And so that doesn't mean they're right, but it does mean this is not fluffy New Age physics. This is really mainstream physics. But does this mean that all physicists, all knowledgeable people working in the field of quantum mechanics, that they all agree with these statements? The top-down approach to history, the observer participancy that John Wheeler spoke of, and so, do they all agree? Is this now consensual knowledge accepted by all knowledgeable physicists? No. They are intelligent. It's cutting edge. Cutting edge in any branch of science means they don't all agree. That's why it's called cutting edge. The consensus is on the backside of the knife. But the cutting edge is where there's still reasonable, intelligent, discerning disagreement. I've cited them because I think they're exactly on the right track, and I have deep, deep confidence in Madhyamaka and Dzogchen. That's what gives me my confidence in John Wheeler, not vice versa, right? But are there assertions within quantum physics, for example, that are not controversial, that are on the backside of the knife, where there's widespread consensus, and not because they're all sheep buying in the same way, because the evidence is overwhelming to people who are very well informed, have a sufficient professional acumen to be able to assess very compelling evidence. Is there anything like that? Well, of course it is. There's an enormous body of knowledge within quantum mechanics where they say, well, this is non-debatable, and here's where we go into interpretation. Some people interpret this way, that way. Okay? So I'm going to now quote Anton Seininger, who's who within experimental physics, within the foundations of quantum mechanics. You know that there's probably just nobody better. He now occupies Erwin Schrödinger's endowed chair at the University of Vienna. He's been on the front page of Scientific American. He was the first one to achieve quantum teleportation, which was kind of a big deal. I hope he gets his Nobel. You have to wait 20 years usually, but sooner or later. I mean, Higgs had to wait, 40 years, wasn't it? About 40 years from the time that Higgs, as in Higgs boson, he formulated Higgs, the boson should exist. 40 years later, when he's an old man, they kind of, you want a Nobel Prize? What? So Andrew Weil, who solved Fermat's last theorem, they gave him the Abel Prize, which is the Nobel Prize of mathematics. Gave him 20 years after he did it. It was 1995, and then they gave it to him a few months ago. 20 years. He got old during that time. I wish they could be speeded up a little bit. If it's good, why not just say give him a handshake and a prize? Within a year anyway. Well, okay. Anton Seining is top drawer. Brilliant. He's also, I know him, he's a lovely man. He's so open-minded, delightful scientist and human being. And so, this was from the conference, the conversation that took place between Anton Seininger and a number of other outstanding physicists in 1997. And it was written up by my mentor, Arthur Zients, who taught me physics at Amherst, in a book called The New Physics and Cosmology, Dialogues with the Dalai Lama. And Anton Seining was a very, very enthusiastic participant in these conversations. And I've quoted him verbatim, okay? So there's no interpretation from me. And I would say with a great deal of confidence, I can always be wrong, of course, that what I'm about to quote from him verbatim is widely accepted, okay? And it's in sharp contradiction, completely annihilates the 19th century notion of individual little bitty granules of hardcore matter that exist objectively, non-locally, but that is locally and objectively real prior to an independent of measurement. Here's what he says, and then we'll go right back to the text. So he says, and I quote, "You can have different concepts like particle and wave, which for us exclude each other." Which is to say, if something's a particle, it's not a wave. You look at all the attributes of particles, look at the attributes of waves. It's about as different as planet Earth as we see it from the multiple photos from outer space and Mount Meru and the four continents. One entity cannot be Mount Meru and the four continents with all the concentric oceans and the planet Earth that we're all familiar with and by and large assumed to be inherently real. One entity can't be both. I heard one time a Geshe trying to map the four continents onto Africa and North America and so forth to try to... And I was translating for him, and it was the most embarrassing moment I've ever had as a translator. Because he's trying to do this, and I was just... It was as much as I could do not to burst into hilarious laughter. It was so completely not possible. And yet this is a fine Geshe, and I'm a student, and so forth. And he saw me going... as his interpreter, which is not polite. And he kept on cranking away, here's the Western continent, here's Africa, and so forth. After this gone on for a while, he turned to me and said, "Oh, never mind." He never brought it up again. So no, don't try to find Mount Meru on the North Pole. Or find, the Western continent in Europe because they have a lot of cows. It's not a good match. Or go to North America. We all know North Americans have no sense of ego, right? Americans especially. The math just doesn't work at all. Any more than you can somehow massage a particle into having the attributes of a wave. Or you can kind of collapse a wave and squeeze it down and crunch it and break all its bones and make it into a little particle. You can't do it. They're completely different. It's a tomato and a giraffe. It's Mount Meru and planet Earth. It is not going to work, right? And that's what he says. I said it more emphatically. Which for us exclude each other. One thing cannot objectively really be a particle and a wave, and that is widely accepted, kind of for obvious reasons. We don't know how to make sense of them together. Why does Bohr, this is Niels Bohr, one of the great architects of quantum mechanics, why does Bohr say these two exclusive ideas are complementary? Why does he say that? And then he answers, because the apparatus that you use to see the wave is different from the apparatus you use to see the path of the particle. And the two apparatuses are complementary. Because neither one, it's not like one's right and one's wrong. They're both right, but not in the same way. Back to him. The important point, which is new in modern physics, that's 20th century physics. Goodbye, 19th century physics. The important point, which is new in modern physics, is that the observer, the experimentalist, decides by choosing the apparatus which of the two features, particle or wave, is reality, which exists. The observer has a very strong influence on nature, which goes beyond anything in classical physics. There's no observer in 19th century physics. They're dealing with a make-believe universe in which observers don't exist. Consciousness doesn't exist. Mind doesn't exist. It's all objective. It's all exterior. And there is no interior. The taboo of subjectivity. And that's the world, by and large, where neuroscientists are still living. And that's why they so casually say, oh, but the mind is the brain. Mind's just a function of the brain. If you're living in the 19th century, what else would you say? Because there's no interior. There's no mind anywhere to be found. The scientific study of the mind hadn't begun. And they felt they were pretty much complete. Lord Kelvin, we've pretty much got a complete picture of the universe now, with no reference to the mind at all. The mind is so irrelevant, so insignificant, we cannot talk about it, and we won't have missed anything important. And check out your cosmology textbooks to this day. I challenge you, from the Big Bang to the present, and show me the reference to consciousness and how it emerged. Good luck with that. Maybe things have changed in the last 30 years since I studied cosmology. I doubt it. So that statement, what do you say, Felipe? His statement, is not representative? That's not controversial. I don't know anybody who knows quantum mechanics who say, oh, no. No, that's just solid. This is consensual knowledge. And I knew that. I've referred to this before, but of course I listened. I was translating for him when he said it. Here's the one that sometimes I forget about. We shouldn't forget it. Because we think of light. Light, is it a wave? Is it a particle? Is it an electromagnetic field or is it a photon? Right? What we forget is the next statement. From, again, direct quote from Anton Seilinger. If you could use the right apparatus, then you would see wave-particle effects for everything. It's not just photons. It's electrons and protons and neutrons. It's atoms, it's molecules. He said everything. That does mean, actually, everything. So let's put this now, and so I'm finished with him. But that's just mainstream. That's consensual knowledge. And moreover, the beauty of this is when he was telling this, and the Dalai Lama was so deeply impressed and loving it, then Anton's response, and he said he's a radical empiricist. I mean, he's really an intense empiricist. And when we had that conversation I've cited earlier, then Anton's invited him. As I said earlier, I'd love to bring you to my lab in Innsbruck. Back then he was in Innsbruck. And I'd like to show you how we've empirically come to this conclusion. We have empirical evidence supporting everything I've said. This is not just some airy-fairy kind of theoretical stuff. He's really an experimentalist. I can show you how these are unavoidable conclusions based upon the evidence. And then His Holiness said, yes, I'm coming. And then I was there, these two great men, and I was there in translating as he went from one laboratory experiment to another. That was so one of the highlights of my life. So now let's apply Madhyamaka to this, and it's really easy to do. You've got an apparatus that when used and you're measuring light, it shows unequivocally, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that light is a field, is a wave. It shows wave interference patterns. I mean, it's got absolutely telltale signs that it cannot not be a wave. Interference patterns and all of that. It's just nothing. You can't draw any conclusion. Like sound waves, waves in water and so forth, wave properties are there. Wave interaction properties are there. Cancellation and so forth, augmentation, it's there. It's nailed. It's certain. But of course, are you seeing the wave? When you use your apparatus, are you seeing the wave? Light. Are you seeing light waves? No. You're seeing appearances, which are the basis of designation for imputing wave. The appearances, the data you have. Is that a wave? Is that a light wave? No way. Are you correctly designating on that basis light as a wave? Yeah. Doesn't get any better. It's like looking at Mary Kay and say, there she is. Yeah, that's Mary Kay. We're finished. We're done. There's nothing more to be said. Was the basis of designation Mary Kay? Never. But is that as good as it gets? Do I need to say something more? No, that's quite sufficient. You've identified Mary Kay. She is that person there. Right? So the basis of designation is not the same as a designated object. The basis of designation is empty of light waves. And if it is, show me the light wave that exists independently of the basis of designation. Try that one out. Here's one wall, here's another wall. You can bang your head as much as you like. You're not going to find the light wave within the basis of the designation. You're not going to find it outside of the basis of the designation. And that's because it's not there. Objectively, independent of the conceptual designation, it's not there. Not in the appearances, not in the data, and not independently of the data. It's not there. Light is empty of being a wave. It's designated as such based upon the type of appearance that arise when you use one kind of apparatus. And then, thank you for the affirmation, and then you have another apparatus, and now you see unequivocally that light, it consists of photons which are like little bullets, like little BBs, little packets of something, and they hit and they make an impact just like little bullets of energy, little packet of energy, right? And it's perfectly clear. Is the appearance, are you actually seeing little bundles of energy? Nobody's ever seen a photon. No. Can't even imagine. Well, they wouldn't look like anything. They're transparent. They don't have color. They don't have shape. So what would it even mean to see a photon? But you do have very compelling evidence. I mean, incontrovertible evidence. Using this apparatus, light does consist of these little packets called photons. Quanta of light. There's no question. Anybody's well informed, you just can't throw that one away. It's the same thing. The basis of designation is empty of photons. You don't find photons in them, you don't find photons independent of them. Photons exist as a conceptual designation using this apparatus. And light is a wave using this apparatus. And both of them are equally empty. So it's a really good thing that we're in the 21st century. Because it's the physics themselves that detonate the metaphysical realism of the 19th century. And they do it with empiricism. And in fact, it's not so obvious, because we don't have that many contemplatives who are achieving shamatha and vipassana. And then demonstrating what can you do if you have that realization. We don't have, or maybe we have a lot and they're hidden yogis. Not for me to say. I don't know. But, you know, there's a few yogis here and there who will conjure up with their minds a leopard or a deer. One lama that I met from Oregon, northern Oregon, Nyingma Lama, he really felt, he's been teaching in the West for quite some years. He has a nice center up there, a lot of students. And he's from Tibet. He left Tibet only fairly recently. And he decided, he thought, you know, I'm going to paraphrase what he said. We Buddhists look a little bit wimpy, and we have all the big talk, but we don't have many people who demonstrate siddhis. The physicists, they can demonstrate their cities unbelievably. Mary Kay just sent me a video of a guy, an engineer, who's creating avatars with virtual reality. He's having a conversation with somebody who appears there, and his body is elsewhere, and the ground on which he's appearing is Mars, and they're having a conversation going back and forth. And of course, he's completely empty of inherent nature. So they're showing their cities. And that's very cool. It makes me really believe, whoa, they really must know something about light, about holographic images. They know a lot because they're showing it. I mean, I have this little, you know, my wish-fulfilling gem here. It gives me clairvoyance, clairaudience, knowing the other's minds, and so forth. I can even tell you, would like to know where my wife is? We're pals. I can tell you where she is, right down to 100 meters. By just going to friends, right? Friends. I have that app. I have to keep an eye on her. She's a mischievous girl. You know. Where were you last night? Oh, okay, you were home. Okay. Where's it going? Find friends. Find your spouse. So I know where my wife is. I can find out. I mean, that is to say, basis of designation of my wife is her cell phone. Wait a minute. Maybe that certainty is not quite so absurd. So this lama from Oregon was saying, you know, I want to find some Tibetan yogis that can actually show that, you know, when you have insight, when you have some good, really powerful samadhi, and you have insight into emptiness, that actually you can show stuff and not just give a really good Dharma talk. You can show stuff, just like with our understanding of holograms, of light, of quantum mechanics, crucial for that. You can't do this without quantum mechanics. Then you can show stuff, you know, and it's going to get more and more interesting as they come out with this virtual reality and so forth. They're showing their cities. It's amazing. It's wonderful. So I think I know I've told the story a few times and I'm rambling a bit, but it's kind of cool that he went back to Tibet looking for some Tibetan yogi that could display cities. And then he found one. He found one off there in the wild lands of Kham in eastern Tibet. And he's known as being a wild yogi. Wild yogi. So he found him. And he found him. And either he saw it with his eyes or he had it based on a very clear report that someone came to this yogi and... the yogi pulled out a gun and shot him 3 times. Bang, bang, bang. He fell over dead. I'm laughing because after he'd done that, he brought him right back to life again. Unharmed, and the guy hopped on his horse and ran away as fast as he could. And this lama from Oregon said, he really has cities, but I'm afraid of him. So I need to find another one that doesn't shoot so quickly. And so he did. He did. He found another one. And I've told his story many times. You know, Lama Gama Gyumen. And he's the one that burned holes in my skin 5 times, you know, with a little kind of Asakri put into his mouth, heated it up to about 1,000 or 2,000 degrees and then burned holes in my skin, as he did a number of other people. It wasn't like he was just fooling around, like, you know, let's find somebody to burn, like, you know, like with a cigarette. You know? It's a form of healing. And he healed many thousands of people. They line up by the thousands when he goes to Beijing, Shanghai. And it's his wrathful mode of healing that he received a boon, a city from Padmasambhava. He demonstrated it. I saw him do it. He did it on me. And it was very intense. I mean, he's melting your skin with something that is about 2,000 degrees. And you feel it. And that's taking it right out of his mouth and then putting the stone in your skin and he burns a hole in it. And you can see the smoke coming out. It's all, I have it all on video. I'll see him again in June, a couple of weeks. He's coming to Los Angeles. I think he's going to burn me again. Because he said I needed it 4 times. So I'll come out like a leopard when I'm in here. Look at my spots. So... that's just flat out impossible, because I saw him do it. And he invited, the Lama from Oregon invited scientists, would you like to see? There's no wires, there's no trickery here. You see, is he actually putting a stone into his mouth, going into samadhi, and then bringing it out, and it's 2,000 degrees and burns holes in people's skin? You see for yourself. No scientist was available. Okay. If you've achieved shamatha and then vipassana, then you can do stuff. Not because you've drawn some really cool conclusions, but actually, it's not the same as, but it's comparable to being lucid in a dream. In a dream, what can't you do? Want to walk through a wall? Walk through a wall. Want to fly? Fly. Want to breathe underwater? Breathe underwater. Want to walk on water? Walk on water. And you don't need to use those nimittas, those signs from the form realm, because they're all empty. So there is some technology that goes with that. Okay, now let's finally get back. Oh my goodness, it's 6 o'clock. Let's read a little bit more, otherwise I'd just be so embarrassed. But he went through this so quickly. You know, they're not real because they're composites. Like, you all got that, right? That I figure, well, you know, we should read that from the 21st century and see. Pull. Vaibhashika is wrong. Classical physics is wrong. This makes the world a lot more interesting. Let's read just a little bit more. So, on the other hand, okay, so the last thing he said was about the basis of designation, going all the way down to very subtle energy mind, identifying the mind in order to determine the nature of existence of the mind. We did that. Then back to the root text. It's very preliminary now. I have to make a little bit of headway in the text. On the other hand, in that state of equipoise, so we're back to shamatha, keeps on coming back to that. In that state of equipoise, the mind is an immaterial, clear vacuity, unobscured, unimpeded, where various things arise and proliferate. Well, that's a clear phenomenological account. Boy, is that true. It is an unceasing stream of clarity and awareness, which I've translated as luminosity and cognizance. Tomatoes, tomatoes. This is all very familiar. This is what you witness. This is how the mind appears. This is how awareness, the flow of consciousness, appears. That's how it appears. Immaterial, clear vacuity, space of the mind, empty, unobscured. All kinds of appearances arising and proliferating, dissolving back into space. And the awareness of all of that is this continuous stream of luminosity and cognizance. But then we have the mind that engages with objects. Okay, now he just covered awareness, right? Just what we did in the last session. We rest in awareness first, but then we allow the mind to conceptually engage, to identify, to conceptually designate. The mind that engages with objects uninterruptedly. The mind that does this, that conceptually designates, there's an object over there, there's Wendy over here, I am over here, and so forth. The mind that is now actively involved in conceptually designating reality, objectifying phenomena, that mind uninterruptedly appears as independent. Something is really over here. And the referent objects we apprehend are, as stated by the guardian Shantideva, so-called continua and collections, like rosaries, armies, and the like, are deceptive, which is to say misleading. Their way of appearance misleads you, is contrary to the way they actually exist. The referent objects, these are the objects of the mind, right? The mind that apprehends them on the one hand, as something that appears, seems to be, really over here, on the subjective side, and the referent objects, the object you're attending to, that we apprehend, they are continual, they're collections like rosaries, armies, and the like. They're deceptive, they're misleading. That said, informed by scripture and reasoning, subtle in meditative equipoise in the state where things do not exist the way they appear. Boy, he's very concise. We're going to pause there, and I'll end with, because that's really loaded, and I'm going to linger just a little bit more. This whole theme of continua. When we look inwards, and I ask this difficult question, so don't feel frustrated. You feel, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know how to do that. When you direct your awareness inwards right upon the mind, and you ask, as this mind that appears to be independent, really in here, what's the basis of designation? That's hard enough. What's harder then, in my experience, is let alone the mind, just awareness, the flow of consciousness, right? Isn't that inherently real? Isn't that prior to and independent of any conceptual designation? Which would make you a chittamatran. Because all that really exists then is just the flow of awareness and all the appearances to awareness, and that's it. There's nothing more. Elementary particles and all of that, these are just concoctions created by the conceptual mind imputed upon things that are immaterial, appearances to the mind. It's all just like a novel. But awareness, isn't that real? And awareness, of course, is a flow, it's a continuum, it's a stream, like rosaries. No, I don't have my rosary with me, but no bead is a rosary, right? But get them all in a continuum, and you say, oh, there's my rosary. An army, just having a bunch of people in uniform is not an army, right? A bunch of people in uniform with weapons is not an army. It's just a bunch of people with weapons and uniforms. That's not an army, right? No individual is an army. Having a whole bunch of these people in the same place is not an army. It's just a bunch of people with armies and with uniforms and weapons. It's just, that's all it is, not an army. But there are armies. They certainly exist. They've been existing a long time. What's the basis of designation for army? the collection of guys in uniforms with weapons, and nowadays women as well. And so is the basis of a designation, is that identical to or different from the designated object? So these are two things in space. Rosary, no single bead. Having a whole bunch of beads in a row, that's not a rosary. A rosary is something designated upon, that which is not a rosary, basis of designation. But the rosary is not found in any individual bead or in the string or in a whole bunch of beads collectively. It's not inherently a rosary. It's a designation upon something that is not a rosary. But what about when we take this to consciousness? Because that's what he's saying. The mind, or the flow of consciousness, is a continuum. It's a continuum. And here I'm going to linger just a bit more so I can feel at peace that I got you somewhere through the text. A little bit of progress. So he quoted Shantideva. Well, the classic commentary to Shantideva's text, The Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, is called Panchika. And it's never been translated into English, but it's there in Sanskrit. And so when my wife and I were translating the text from Sanskrit and Tibetan, we're the only people that translate it from both languages, then here's what the commentary says, right to that verse. And it's very relevant to our practice, and then we can go. I'll let you out. It's chapter 9, 101, verse 101, wisdom chapter, of course. He said, the commentator here, quite a definitive commentary from India, the continuum of consciousness, like a series, and the aggregation of constituents, like an army and the like, an army, a rosary, and so forth. So we have, these are both composites, right? The army is composed of many people, weapons, and so forth and so on. And a continuum is composed, it's also a composite. The flow of consciousness is a composite, not spread out in space, but spread out in time. It's a continuum of pulses, moments of consciousness, okay? So the continuum of consciousness, like a series, and so on the one hand, consciousness, there's the subjective side, and the aggregation of constituents, so like a rosary, like an army, like an elementary particle, which also has parts, has constituent parts, like galaxies and everything else in the physical universe, all consists of composites. So now we have one extended in time, the other one is extended in space and time, are unreal. The continuum of consciousness, like a series, and the aggregation of constituents, like an army and the like, are unreal. The Panchika, in the commentary, reads, and I quote, a continuum, or in Sanskrit, santana, does not exist as some ultimately existent entity. Continuum is not inherently real. However, it has the form or appearance of a successive stream of moments that have arisen as the condition of causes and effects. That is, continuum arises, independence upon cause and effect. Each pulse of cognition is also conditioned, arises independence upon causes, produces its effect. It has the form of a successive stream of moments that have arisen as the condition of causes and effects because of the non-perceptibility of a distinct moment. So how is it that you can say a continuum, the flow of your own consciousness, make it very personal, let's not intellectualize this, just get lost in thought. Let the words just bring us the finger to the moon, right back to your own awareness. Your awareness of awareness, your awareness of the own continuum of your awareness. And the assertion here is that this flow is comprised of individual, extremely brief moments of consciousness. And the fundamental units, the shortest pulse of consciousness is non-perceptible, of a distinct moment, of an individual moment. We're going to linger there a bit longer if you don't mind your dinner getting cold. Won't be too long. This is not technical, but useful. Otherwise, I think we're not going to penetrate this. And that is in the classic Abhidhamma Kosha, the Indo-Tibetan tradition. When they speak of, they call it Dute Kachima, the shortest moment of time, the pulse of time, pulse of, for example, consciousness. What's the briefest? Well, they say it's finite. It's finite. Conceptually, you can say, well, what's half of that? What's a hundredth of that? What's a millionth of that? Conceptually, of course, you can divide it as much as you like. But in terms of observation, phenomenologically, without just conceptually dicing, phenomenologically, what's the briefest pulse? And they say it's 1/65th of a finger snap, the duration of a finger snap. Okay? So I do the obvious thing. How long does a finger snap take? About 1/10 of a second. If you're a big, meaty person, you know, big, big fat fingers, maybe it's only a fifth of a second. If you're like gache, it could be 1/20th of a second. Arriba, arriba! Really, really fast, you know. Wind people, they're very fast. So their finger snaps could be a bit shorter. But if you're kind of just ordinary like me, about the 10th of a second. Okay? So if the basic unit, the most primitive, the shortest pulse of awareness, of consciousness, is 1/10th of a finger snap. Finger snap is 1/65th, 65 per second. Wait a minute, did I say it? Yeah, 60, what did I say? I got it right. I know that. Oh yeah, 65 pulses in your finger snap. And a finger snap is 1/10th of a second. This means 1/650th, roughly about 2 milliseconds. Roughly about 2 milliseconds would be the basic unit. Okay. Well, I work with Paul Ekman and so forth. I know a number of people who know a lot more than I do. And I actually participated in a very brief study. And from the last I heard, which is about 10 years old, what psychologists can ascertain, and they've got really good technology for this, that the briefest moment that you can actually ascertain something, and in the experiment that I was involved in, Paul would project an image on a screen, something really primitive, like a triangle, a square, project it on a screen, so you're looking right at it, and they can do this with, you know, extreme precision, but something really primitive, square, circle, triangle, something like that, project it, and then they mask it. Because if you don't mask it, then there's a repercussion effect in the brain, and it gets sloppier, smudged. It gets smudged. But they would flash it there for like 1/10th of a second, 100 milliseconds. And you pretty much, if you're paying attention, you probably get it. 200 milliseconds, you almost certainly, unless you get really drowsy, 1/5th of a second, you should get it. Get to 100 milliseconds, 1/10th of a second. Some people get it, some people don't. Get down to 1/20th of a second, 50 milliseconds. That takes some training. Paul knows how to train people when he's doing facial recognition and being able to identify extremely fleeting, very, very brief facial expressions that come and go really, really quickly. He can train people so that you can identify a square, a triangle, a masked image. It comes on for 1/20th of a second and get it right. From the research that I was aware of 10 years ago, that's pretty much the limit. If it goes down to 20 milliseconds, 10 milliseconds, 5 milliseconds, 2 milliseconds, you can be looking right at it with great interest and focus, and you won't see it. It's just too short. Have you heard anything different since then? You know anything? Okay. So it's right ballpark. It might be a little bit tweaked by then, but Paul knows what he's doing, and it was with a colleague of his at UC Berkeley. And so what that is called in Buddhism, it's called Jajoki Kechikma, in terms of consciousness. It's a moment that enables an activity to be completed. And the activities in question was, it was a square. Not saying it, that's the, you know, the exhaust after the event has taken place, but you actually recognized, as you were gazing right at it, a 50 millisecond flash and masked, and you ascertain it. That's, you just completed an action. You're able to distinguish a square from a triangle from wood. You didn't see anything at all, right? And so the moment that is required for an action to be completed, that's not set. It's not the same for everything. For example, if you're experiencing ambivalence or uncertainty, shall I go learn Tibetan in this place, or shall I just go into retreat? They both have merits. Shall I or shall I not? That's called uncertainty. It's not afflictive uncertainty necessarily, but it's certain. I haven't made up my mind yet. This has certain advantages, this has advantages, this has limitations. To experience doubt as you're oscillating between two alternatives, that's a lot more than 100 milliseconds, right? That could be a second, could be 2 seconds, much longer. Square, 50 milliseconds. But the point he's making here, Panchik is making, Benjamin Bush is making, Shanda Dave is making, is that when you impute stream of consciousness upon the units that make it up, the units themselves are invisible. The individual units, those two millisecond bursts, if they weren't there, then you couldn't have a compilation of them, an aggregation of them, wondering, shall I or shall I not go to that, you know, Tibetan language school? If there were no moment, then there would just be nothing happening at all, right? It'd be like an army with no soldiers, right? But it would be like viewing an army from afar where you can't see any of the individuals. You can't make out one. But you can see, Po, there's a large army coming over the hill, 10 miles away. Whoa, that's a big army. Can't see a single individual. But if there are no individuals, you couldn't see the army. You can't see the individual spikes of consciousness, but spread out over time, you can designate them. So that's what he's getting at here, that the basis of designation, once again, is not identical to that which you're imputing upon it. The army is not the individuals, and it's not the collection of the individuals. The very notion of collection of individuals is itself a designated object. When does a bunch of soldiers become a collection? How close do you need to be holding hands? Do they need to be tight, you know, in a good cluster so you can bomb them easily? Or like good soldiers for how long, when they see the incoming artillery, what do they do? Spread out, right? Is a spread out army still an army? What if they've divided into three parts and they're coming in like with good mallet, you know, get them from the flank, get them from the rear? Is it still an army? Now it's over here, it's over there, it's over there. Yeah. When did it become an army? It's some guys over there and some over here and over here. When did it become an army? Oh, when you conceptually designated it as an army. Right. And they've designated themselves as an army. That's why they're acting in coordination with each other. So it gets interesting, yeah? That the last stronghold in this strategy, the last stronghold when you're about to take the king, you know, if this were chess, is that which you know most indubitably, awareness. That's real. Whether I'm thinking or I'm not thinking, that's real. Appearances are real. But even when there are no appearances in our sensory deprivation tank, the perfect one, no appearances, there's something still real. Awareness. Until you check out. That's a noun. What's the basis of designation? And the basis of designation is empty of the designated object. And the chess game's over. Sarva shunya. Everything's empty, equally empty. Final point on that one, because the air is very thin here, to be sure. But you know, the whole issue of boundaries, demarcation. Where does an electron start? Where does the army end? Is it on the skin of the guy who's out on the flank? Is that where it ends? Really? What if he goes inside? Now where's the boundary? Where exactly is the boundary? You know it until you think about it, until you examine it. If you have two soldiers here, is the boundary between them? It's kind of like an invisible membrane. You know, the guy's on the outskirts, the space in between them. Is that where the boundary is, where there's nothing there at all? Well, boy, that's about as clearly imputed as you could ever imagine, because there's nothing there at all, but you just decided that's where this army starts. What about when two armies clash in the old days, you know, swords and bayonets and all of that? Now where's the army? When they're all mixed with each other, stabbing and jabbing and shooting and gouging and so forth. Now where's the army? Where's the boundary? Colors. Blue, civil war, blue and gray. That's where your army is. My army's invaded your army. Oh, then they just got wiped out. Now my, oh. Conceptual designation all the way through, upside, downside, everywhere. Boundaries. The boundaries are conceptually imputed. The boundary of an electron, we look at gravitational field. It does have a gravitational field. It has an electromagnetic field. And it goes on in all directions. Where are you going to bring out your cookie cutters and say, okay, this is where the electrons start? I mean, you know. The body seems to have a skin, but of course you're emanating energy. You're emanating thermal energy. You're emanating electromagnetic energy from your body. So where does your body start? Just because where you see it? Don't think so. Why? That's just a conceptual designation. Right. So when it comes to awareness, in our experience, almost invariably, awareness is always aware of something. appearances, thoughts, images, colors, people, deer? Where's the boundary? Where's the boundary between awareness and not awareness? Because appearances are not awareness. Appearances are not aware of anything. Red is not aware of something, right? Awareness and its objects. A stone of which you are aware is not aware of anything. You're aware of it, it's not aware of you. So whether it's a thing like a stone or whether it's a color or a sound is not awareness, you're aware of the sound. Where's the boundary? Where's the boundary? Between awareness, went this far, and then it stopped. Where's your boundary? Where's the boundary between awareness and that of which you're aware? The appearance or the object, either way, where's the boundary? Because if you say awareness is really there, then you're not saying you're omniscient, right? You're not saying your awareness permeates the whole of the universe. That's not your experience. It must have some boundaries. Where's the boundary? If awareness is inherently existent, really existent, independent of conceptual designation, then it also has to have its own inherently existent boundary. The demarcation point between awareness and not awareness. Awareness and appearances to awareness. Where's the boundary? Oh, yeah. So, now your dinner's all cold. But not inherently so. If that's any consolation, which I assume it's not. So that was fun. So. Jolly good.